We're discussing domestic violence and what can be done to stop it. This is a difficult conversation, so please take care as you're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A headline late last year in the New England Journal of Medicine, physicians described intimate partner violence during COVID as a pandemic within a pandemic. They found the pandemic highlighted just how much more work needs to be done to ensure that people who experience abuse can continue to get support, refuge, medical care when a public health disaster strikes. Were you in an abusive relationship? Did the pandemic and stay-at-home orders affect your ability to get help? What resources do you wish you had access to? 800-642-1234. Monique Minkins is Executive Director of End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. Monique, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
We also have Tiffany Parker here, who is Director of Inpatient Behavioral Health Addiction Services and Domestic Violence Services with Ignition Healthcare in Fond du Lac, which is a part of SSM Health. Tiffany, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me as well.
Well, Tiffany, let's start with you. You know, asking for help can be difficult. What are some of the obstacles that you face for your staff in providing support for victims of domestic violence?
So particularly, as you mentioned before, with the pandemic, it was quite challenging in the beginning to navigate how we can still reach victims of domestic violence and their families safely. With having the lockdowns in place, we didn't want to put someone in potentially more danger by reaching out in the ways that we had developed previously, where patients were able to come in person and, you know, potentially tell the person in their household that was harming them that they were going to such and such appointment and able to kind of cover that by coming into our clinic. And so when we learned of these things, our staff, particularly at our agency, you know, got together as a team and started to figure out for each type of patient and each patient's unique situation, what were ways that we could help with this. One of the things that our team did develop as a greater resource for these patients is it developed an educational program that recurred virtually once a month. It couldn't be necessarily a support program. Again, trying to be mindful and careful about someone, you know, doing a support group within their home, but doing an educational program and being able to have still some access. And again, this is a way also for clinicians to, if they didn't have regular contact, be able to know that their patient was okay.
Yeah.
So there are different ways to get creative that way.
Monique, what have you seen through End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin in this pandemic as you try to reach out and serve survivors and advocates?
We have definitely seen an increase in domestic violence since the pandemic. You know, it's not just the increase, it's the severity of the situations that have also intensified. And there are still some stats that have yet to be collected, and yet nationwide we know that DV incidents rose by 8.1% during the pandemic shutdowns. And this is by an analysis by the National Commission on COVID-19 and Criminal Justice. And we don't have those statistics in Wisconsin. And yet the stories that I hear from programs indicates to me that there has been an uptick and that the severity of the cases have left advocates really struggling as well.
You know, something I know you've talked about before, Monique, that weighs heavily on your mind is the underreporting, the inability to reach people of all backgrounds who can't reach out for help or who don't trust authorities. What do you think must be done to better serve the whole community?
You know, I think that we have to look at how we set up the system and go from there and undo it. You can try and insert some things into a system that was already not serving people, or you can, sometimes it's okay to reinvent the wheel so that you are having all of these voices come in that have not necessarily been at the table. And so we have to find ways to hear all survivors and find out what it is they're asking for that they need in order to meet those needs and move accordingly, trusting that they are the experts of what they need and of themselves. That would be that's where I would start.
Yeah. Tiffany, what about you? What training have you been focusing on for your staff so that you can better meet the needs and really meet victims where they're at?
I wholeheartedly agree with Monique. I think they're the experts. Our clients and patients are the experts of their relationship, and we've been really relying on them at this time as to what they need. And honestly, some of those things really purely are basic needs. You know, we look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and if someone's basic needs at the bottom are not met first, we can't continue, you know, to offer advocacy, to offer therapy, to offer potentially psychiatric care. Sometimes those things cannot really be accomplished or accomplished successfully until we really meet the basic needs. One of the things we see a lot right now is childcare issues. We're having, particularly with the pandemic too, that was another barrier. Oftentimes the daycares were shut down. We didn't have enough staff. And so a lot of our clients, we made accommodations at times to have clients with their children at the clinic because there wasn't really an option otherwise. And it was kind of one of those safety types of situations. But unfortunately, when parents are bringing their children into session or they're bringing them in, sometimes they're, as you can imagine, quite distracted and not able to really focus on themselves because they have those other responsibilities. And so, again, our agency has been really focusing on different creative ways to raise funds or to create different relationships in the community for resources to meet those basic needs first prior to processing more of that therapeutic need that the patient has.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Tiffany Parker, who directs inpatient behavioral health, addiction services, and domestic violence services with Ignition Healthcare in Fond du Lac. Monique Minkins leads End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin, serving survivors and advocates around the state for over 40 years. You can join in. Where do you see a domestic violence in your life, in your community, and how have you tried to make a difference? Did you ever leave someone because they displayed abusive behavior? What was that red flag for you? How did you make an exit plan? 800-642-1234. Monique, looking at children in domestic violence situations and in these conflicts, what do you see there and how do you help the kids?
You know, it's domestic violence. It affects everyone. It affects the whole community, the whole family, including the children. I often think of when I see an Amber Alert, the first thing I think is that's domestic violence. And often, lots of times it is. And so it does affect the children. It affects how they navigate in school and how they navigate among their friends. There are lots of statistics that show that as they get older, some children perpetuate what they've seen, and some choose to do differently. And it affects how they feel secure in their home. And sometimes there is this triangulation that the person that's making a family feel unsafe will do so that there is some leverage. And so the child is often in the middle of the situation as well. And trying to decide which parent. And so lots of times when families do separate or the person that's surviving leaves, it's a recreation or a rebuilding of that relationship between parent and child because of the situation.
Tiffany, how do you navigate those relationships, the child in the situation?
I think we have this challenge often in this field because oftentimes when we are in touch with a child or in touch with a parent who's bringing a child, obviously, for therapy treatment, there's typically, you know, one parent presenting or one parent's perspective. And so it's a challenge for therapists in the clinic oftentimes to, you know, be objective to what the situation is based on how the parent is presenting. I think that the biggest thing that our clinicians know, what we train our staff to know, is that we have to follow our ethical guidelines and be as objective as possible and try to have multiple perspectives when working with that child to preserve whatever relationships, positive and healthy relationships, they still have with their parents, despite who may be the person making them feel unsafe or the person that is unfortunately receiving the abuse in the household that they may be witnessing. Because we do know and that children can still have that those feelings of affection and love for the person that is being harmful.
Tiffany Parker there. She directs domestic violence services with Ignition Healthcare. Monique Minkins, executive director of End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin, a statewide coalition to end domestic abuse. You can join in. Did you ever leave an abusive relationship? What was that like for you? What questions do you have about domestic violence, assault, abusive relationships? Join in any point, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. We're discussing intimate partner violence, how to break the cycle. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The World Health Organization, it calls it a major public health problem. Globally, the WHO says about 1 in 3 women experienced physical or sexual violence, mostly by an intimate partner. Have you or a loved one been in an abusive relationship? Did you seek help? Are you with an organization supporting victims of domestic violence? What is your work like? Join in, 800-642-1234. Tiffany Parker works on domestic violence services for Ignition Healthcare, and Monique Minkins leads End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. Monique, we heard recently that Sojourner Family Peace Center launched a 24-hour domestic violence text line in Milwaukee. And I'm wondering what you think of that in trying to reach people, bring resources, make it easier for people to reach out for help.
I think it's amazing. As long as we can find a safe way for people to contact services, we need to do that. It's not just pick up the phone or stop by. Those options aren't always available. Someone maybe can't talk, but they can text. And so if that is an option that is available, most definitely, I think it should be an option for as many people as we can make it available to. And so I remember hearing about that, or I when I heard about it, I thought this is really amazing. And I think about, you know, younger people who text, although it used to be that it was mostly younger people, but younger people who text and text a joiner who may or may not be able to serve them, but can connect them to other services that are available. And so any way that we can reach people is golden.
Yeah. I'm wondering, what are ways that you are able to reach out to victims and to be able to get them comfortable speaking and feeling safe? I mean, what have been some effective avenues for you?
You know, when I think about in domestic abuse, we are not a direct service organization. We're the state coalition for the programs around the state. Mm-hmm. And so when someone calls us, and they usually call or they email, then we connect them to a program. And yet I know that programs, sometimes if they are tabling at an event, they may make contact with someone. They may have a walk-in. Someone may call. And so those are a lot of the ways. Sometimes they will email. Sometimes it's a family member that calls and asks questions to get them in the door or to break the ice. And so there are different ways. Sometimes the police will bring someone to an organization. Lots of different ways that people contact. And there are also what is, I think, has really picked up traction is mobile advocacy, where organizations are going to people in different places out in the community. That's been really amazing.
Can you give an example of that? Mobile advocacy?
It removes the barrier for people to be able to get to the organization's physical site. And so, for example, someone contacts an organization, and the organization has an MOU with other entities out in the community, the library, a hospital, and they may meet them at that location and gather information there and offer them support and services.
Let's bring in Cindy now in Stevens Point. Hi, Cindy. What would you like to share?
Okay. I'm 61 years old. I went through abuse in my 20s. I was married. My husband was a Vietnam veteran. I think that had a lot to do with it. But also, I think what's going on in the United States today is drug and alcohol abuse contributes so much to abuse, verbal abuse and physical abuse. And I think the breakdown of the family is happening because there is no one at home when those children get off of that bus or get home from school. So I think that's why the violence, the drugs, all of that is happening, is because there is not the family unit anymore that there used to be. So that is my comment.
And Cindy, decades removed now from your abuse, do you feel like you're in a better state in life?
Yes, I do. But also it has caused me not to have a long-lasting relationship with anyone because I am so picky about who I want in my life. And I want to make sure that that never happens again, because the abuse didn't just happen to me. It happened to my children. And then what happens is it goes on, the yelling or the getting upset over stuff too quickly and not picking your fights instead of just, you know, just let some things go. But the thing is relationships are breaking down because of drug and alcohol abuse.
Well, Cindy,
and there's just so much of it out there.
Cindy, I want to thank you for sharing your personal story. Tiffany, how would you respond?
I think what Cindy expresses, there is a lot of there are a lot of trends that we see with the breakdown of the family. We know if you're familiar at all with the ACE study that focuses on traumatic events prior to the age of 18, that was done in the California area years ago. We're using a lot of trauma-informed care strategies in a lot of our systems now, in a lot of our organizations, within even our domestic violence programs within the state related to trauma-informed care, because we know that a lot of children are experiencing mental illness in the home, substance abuse in the home, or other related stressors, whether that's, and that could be, those could be coping strategies that lead to physical violence or sexual violence and things to that nature. I would agree with Cindy that a lot of those issues are impacting homes and unfortunately breaking them apart and leading to unfortunately more situations where children are seeing the cycle, seeing the abuse, and then unfortunately could be repeating that as an adult if not knowing what normal healthy relationships are.
We're talking with Tiffany Parker of Ignatian Healthcare in Fond du Lac and Monique Minkins of End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. Monique, you know, looking at those overlapping issues in domestic violence, poverty, mental health, substance abuse, as Cindy brought up, can you address that in how that plays into what you see going on?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think domestic violence is a symptom of something greater. And we have to go to the root of why there is domestic violence. And we know it's about power and control, right? And we also know that we have to look at where the desire for this power and control comes from. And so I think that one thing I love my movement, and one thing I would love for us to do is look at the whole family and the whole person, all people that are involved in it, and look at what got someone here to start there. And on both sides, because there are red flags that come up and what tells us that these flags are okay. And please know, I am not victim blaming. And there is something greater. It's not just the domestic violence. It's the historical trauma. It's the generational trauma. It's all of those things that bring us to this point. And we have to deconstruct and unpack those things in order for us to move forward. And so when I think about how we respond to domestic violence, we respond in a way that is punitive and that leaves someone outside of society instead of pulling everyone in and asking everyone what happened to you and how do we move forward. And if we started there, I think we would have different results, and people would feel valued and feel like there is some control of the situation. Yeah. You know, I really do appreciate Cindy for calling in today, and I'm glad that she's still here.
Monique Minkins is Executive Director of End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. Tiffany Parker, Director of Inpatient Behavioral Health, Addiction Services, and Domestic Violence Services with Agnesian Healthcare, a part of SSM Health. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll continue our conversation about this right after a news update on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we look at the problem of intimate partner violence and what breakthroughs are working to bring healing. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is a sensitive conversation, so do please take care. The Sojourner Family Peace Center in Milwaukee, as we said earlier, recently launched a 24-hour text message hotline telling the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel the service will allow people who lack privacy to get help quickly and discreetly. Do you know someone who may be in an abusive situation? How have you tried to step in? What questions do you have about being an ally? Join in 800-642-1234. Tia Love is a domestic violence advocate for the OSHA Project based in Milwaukee. She provides services to victims of domestic and sexual violence and trafficking, and she leads the Sister Circle support groups. Tia, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, could we walk in your footsteps here for a moment? What might a typical day be like for you as a domestic violence advocate?
It varies. There are several different types of typical days, depending on, you know, kind of what's going on in the country, what's going on locally. But I'm, you know, constantly, I engage in direct service. So you could say my typical day might look like getting a referral once our office manager gets a call on our hotline. And, you know, she'll refer out to one of the advocates. And so she'll send a message, hey, we got this person who needs help with this. And then I make the connection. Yeah. Call, you know, hey, what's going on? I got your referral. What are you needing help with? And from, you know, and it kind of takes off from there. And they all need different things. Of course, in all situations, some form of abuse is present, but oftentimes that's not the presenting problem. And I was listening to the show earlier, and one of the ladies was talking about how it's the basic needs that they often come in search of: housing, food, resources for their children. All these things are not necessarily symptoms, but a part of, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Results of the abuse and the, you know, the negative relationship.
Kind of the ripple effect
of it.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, providing services after finding out what the problem is.
I'm really curious. You also lead the Sister Circle support groups. What are they like? Yeah.
It is a space, an informal space for people, specifically women and women who have been abused or women who are affected by people, you know, situations of abuse, to come together and just fellowship. Sometimes we talk about abuse. Sometimes we talk about things that have nothing to do with abuse, at least not directly. It's really just a safe space to come and build fellowship and find connections and relationships that I believe people who are abused typically don't have.
Have you been able to make those connections and relationships happen in the pandemic?
Not really, no. So, yeah, Sister Circle shut down last year, obviously, because of the pandemic. And it hasn't really been able to kick off virtually. Mm. It's definitely something that's more beneficial in person because of the weight of what's being discussed.
Yeah. And certainly being in close proximity to someone where you can see them eye to eye and they're in your mm-hmm. space, that can have such an impact, I would imagine.
It does. Because, you know, we come together, we eat, and it's, you know, and that's just a hard thing to recreate over a Zoom call or a Google Meet, you know, so to create a space safe enough that someone feels like they can share something that they might not have shared anywhere else. And also a lot of times that sister circle is an opportunity for someone to get out of their home and get somewhere safe where they can talk about those things.
Your organization is culturally specific, focused on helping African Americans. And I'm wondering, why do you think culturally specific domestic violence services and programs are really important?
Well, people in my community have a general distrust of most systems that are in place, whether they're to serve and protect or, you know, to enforce.
Yeah.
So oftentimes when a person is being abused or, you know, they feel like their life is in danger, they don't feel like it's, you know, it's almost choosing the lesser of two evils. And it's just like I could call the police or, you know, reach out to someone about this and seek help. But then that invites all of these other evils, quote unquote, into my life. So like a lot of my clients, you know, when they did reach out to the police, they're oftentimes seen as the aggressor and they get arrested or their children get taken away. So culturally specific programs are important, not just for my people, but for, you know, across cultures, because there are things that I believe the wider culture, you know, can't understand without necessary context and information or can't relate to, which I think is also important in making a connection to help somebody with something as serious as domestic violence and sexual assault.
Tia, you bring something up that I'm wondering about as you talk about bringing in the authorities or the police. And, you know, with Wisconsin statute makes arrests mandatory in domestic abuse mm-hmm. cases where, you know, any crime has been committed. How do you feel like about that? And what effect does that have on your work?
The statute for me is kind of, it's a double-edged sword. Uh-huh. But I do agree, you know, and before the statute was put in place, obviously it was very easy for a abuser to return home after the police left and just, you know, re-traumatize and abuse again. So I do think that mandatory arrest can be positive, but I think in situations where things aren't being approached from a cultural perspective, that it's very easy for a police officer who isn't trained in cultural competence to look at a Black woman and not see her as a victim, because she can come off as an aggressor, or she doesn't, you know, she doesn't present as what a victim is, as what we're told a victim should look like. So sometimes they're both getting arrested, or sometimes, you know, she might be the one who called the police, but the police come and she, you know, she's yelling and she's aggressive. So they misconstrue and she gets arrested. So it's a double-edged sword for me. But oftentimes it's not even something that I really deal with, because most of my clients don't call the police.
Yeah. Tia Love is with us, a domestic violence advocate for the ASHA Project in Milwaukee, based in Milwaukee. What questions do you have about domestic violence, assault, abusive relationships? 800-642-1234. Bradamante is with us from Waukesha. Hi, Bradamante.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. What would you like to add?
From my point of view, one of the great impediments for women to be able to safely leave these kinds of relationships is family court. I know from being in group in multiple women's centers, that's the biggest concern. There was a study done for the Department of Justice by Dr. Sanders, who found that women had bad outcomes. They tended to be pathologized for the PTSD symptoms that they had as a result of abuse, and tended to lose custody. Shared custody is also a common outcome because abuse is just not taken seriously by family courts.
Dr. John Myers of Georgetown did a follow-up on his study that was more comprehensive and got the same outcomes. So women are staying in abusive relationships because they're afraid of where their children will end up. And people who do successfully leave are not able to protect their children because abuse is not taken seriously when it comes to placement decisions in family court.
Bradamonte, thank you for your perspective. Tia, what do you make of those comments about family court?
I 100% agree. Almost 99% of the clients I've served in my time at ASHA have had their children removed from the home because of domestic violence, which to me is a gross miscarriage of justice. You know, a woman finally seeking help against someone who is causing her and her children harm, and family court's response is to remove her children from the home, which, you know, further traumatizes, and it's never made sense to me.
Breaks apart the relationship. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's bring in a police officer, Joel, joining us from Onalaska. Joel, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. I just wanted to make a quick comment about the distrust, and I can totally appreciate certain populations, special populations, especially as victims, distrust of systems and sometimes law enforcement specifically. So, you know, I can appreciate that. But I wanted to also lift up, at least my local experience, that resource providers are very careful with confidentiality and protecting victims' information and names and all that stuff. So I feel like they do a really good job. Maybe the guest can lift up her agency's work to protect confidentiality to help people feel comfortable reaching out. I don't know. Just wanted to lift that up.
Yeah.
Second, I just want to have a quick question too. Sorry. What kind of communication did you get from your local law enforcement for referring cases and potential victims and stuff?
Joel, thank you. Tia, go ahead.
So we don't typically get our referrals from the police. I know Sojourner gets referrals through districts. I'm not sure which ones, but we don't get our referrals through the police typically. It hasn't happened frequently enough for it to be a thing.
Okay. And what about confidentiality that Joel was saying there, that, you know, resource providers are really careful about protecting people's identity?
I mean, it's standard practice to keep, you know, and not discuss what a client tells you unless they give you the right to do so. You know, and across when you're helping someone who's in a domestic violence relationship, you often do have to pull in other systems and resources that your organization might not have or have access to. And so in those cases, you always get permission from your client. Hey, I want to be able to speak on your behalf to this organization and get you the resources that you need, but only about, you know, certain specifics of your case, not everything that you told.
We have Tia Love with us, who is with the ASHA Project in Milwaukee, providing community-based African-American culturally specific services for victims of domestic violence and sex trafficking. Where are you on the path of healing from interpersonal violence? Do you find a stigma towards survivors? Are you believed? Have you been blamed before for not leaving the abuser? How did that feel? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Tia Love on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're honing in on domestic violence, how to break the cycle. Tia Love is with the ASHA Project in Milwaukee. Its programs and outreach work to eliminate gender-based violence and the sexual exploitation of women and children in African-American communities. Tia Love is an advocate supporting domestic abuse survivors, and still time to talk about solutions in your community, how you're involved. 800-642-1234. Tia is with us for about 9 more minutes. Tia, how long might you work on a case, or when do you realize you see resolution in a client? How does that work?
So there's not a typical time frame because everyone's needs are different, of course. You know, some people need one thing that can be resolved within a couple of hours. Some people require constant connection and counseling. And they need someone to talk to. So it could be 6 months, years. But the client lets you know when they're ready. And you know, and the more you do the work, the more you can see, okay, this person has taken the necessary steps, has developed a plan, you know, for what comes next, and knows that if they do fall back into old patterns of behavior that might be harmful, that I'm still here, because this is not just a one-off situation. And I'm not here to judge you if you go back. I'm not here to judge you if you get into another abusive relationship. I'm here to support and reinforce safety for you and your kids. So,
because, you know, there is that perception of judging and shame that, you know, why didn't they leave the relationship sooner? Or, you know, why couldn't they go? How do you work through that, those feelings?
It helps to have personal experience. And also just, you know, understanding the true horrors of domestic violence, because it's not just about putting your hands on someone. Domestic violence is 100% mental and psychological. And I think that the average person just doesn't understand that. So it is very easy to look, to be on the outside looking at someone's situation and saying, well, if it was me, I would just leave. Mm. And the person in that situation probably felt the same before they got there. So keeping that at the forefront and realizing that oftentimes, especially for Black women, victims don't see themselves as victims, which makes it that much harder to leave. So that's how I keep, you know, I keep those thoughts at the forefront when dealing with, like, it can be frustrating, you know, especially when you give them the information and you give them the tools and resources to make better decisions. But one of the things I learned when I was in school was about stages of change. Change is not linear. It's more circular, if anything. And also realizing that just because I'm ready for a certain part of the change to take place doesn't mean that my client is.
Mm, yeah.
And, you know, so keeping it, always taking it back on to what the client wants.
You're really following their cues. I'm wondering, can you describe any of your personal experience and how you've relayed that to your clients?
So my personal experience, I haven't personally been physically abused. I've suffered at the hands of, like, mental and emotional abuse. And for me, it was about, I got a lot of therapy. You know, that was a personal decision that I made. And, you know, once I was able to kind of step outside of that situation and view myself, you know, in that way, that was kind of one of the things that I realized I wanted to help other women do. Mm-hmm. But I've seen it up close in friends and family members. So it's always been a part of my life, whether directly or indirectly. And realizing that the judgment that, again, most people will have when they don't understand does more harm than good.
I was just going to say, you know, mental health therapy services, as you refer out for that, do you find that you're able to get your clients the ability to get those therapy services?
Yes. I know we're connected to a few organizations in the city that we refer to specifically, and any clients that's needed mental help, whether for themselves or for their children, that's something I take serious, because I do know the value in, you know, getting help if you feel like there is mental health issues on the table.
Yeah. Tia Love, domestic violence advocate for the ASHA Project, and taking your questions about domestic violence, assault, abusive relationships, 800-642-1234. Marcus is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, Kate. So I just like to state that it's not always women that are being abused. I was actually hit by one of my kids' mothers in Children's Hospital. It was caught on camera. I hadn't provoked it. A nurse saw that she hit me. I was referred to the Sojourner Truth House, and basically they just said, you know, like, you're a guy, you know, a tough break, even though she had hit me, and she was arrested on the grounds because it's county grounds, so she was arrested by the sheriff. And, you know, I just like to just bring attention to the fact that it's not always women. Men can also be abused too. And unfortunately, you know, it's not necessarily, you know, it's like we should just defend ourselves, but I'm not going to put my hands on a woman, especially my child's mother.
Mm. Marcus, thanks. Tia.
Yes.
What would you say there in terms of, you know, this is not just women who are abused?
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. And our services are available to men and women. And I've, you know, I've seen men come through the door and get the same type of assistance in that we provide for women. We have met, we have a male advocate in our office who works exclusively with the men who come through. It's obviously, it's, the numbers are different, but if those services are needed, which they sometimes are, we don't hesitate to provide that service. But I agree with the caller, Marcus. There do tend to be barriers to services for men because of the judgment. People look at a man who's being abused and they do kind of say that, even indirectly, well, you know, what am I supposed to do? You're a man. Why didn't you defend yourself?
Let's go
to, you know, and that's, yeah. I don't want to invalidate Marcus's point.
Let's bring in John in Madison. John, hi.
I'm curious as to what percentage of these calls that they get are people that are just against the person that they're living with, or, you know, make up of stories regarding abuse when there's not evidence of the physical. And, you know, what it does to their lives by being involved in a situation like that. And many times one lies and the other swears to it.
Well, let's get Tia to respond there. You know, have you ever encountered a story that you found that was made up?
No. Some people do embellish or will massage the details, but any individual I've worked with who's claimed abuse, there's always been evidence to point to that fact.
Tia, as we start to wrap up here, how could we better educate ourselves on intimate partner violence and other forms of abuse?
I would suggest reading as much as possible. Don't take cues from social media because everybody has their own opinions about things. But reading, looking up the facts and the statistics. I would suggest going to the National Center Against Domestic Violence, their website, ncadv.org, I believe. That's where I get a lot of my, or I got a lot of my information when I first started this journey. And they're constantly updating their website with information as well as resources throughout the country.
Well, Tia, thank you for joining us and thank you for your work.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Tia Love is a domestic violence advocate for the ASHA Project. And earlier, we spoke with Tiffany Parker of Agnesian Healthcare in Fond du Lac and Monique Minkins with End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. The National Domestic Violence Hotline operates 24/7. That number is 800-799-SAFE. That's 800-799-7233. Online, it's at thehotline.org. That's thehotline.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.